I think I'm okay.
At this time, we're on record in Berrien versus Berberian, and I'm sure I did not do those names justice. On behalf of the appellant, Galust and Julia Berrien, Robin Dunn will argue, and on behalf of the respondents, Ovanes and Sirocco Berberian, Larry Larson will argue. Are there any preliminary matters, Mr. Dunn or Mr. Larson?
None from the plaintiff appellant.
Very well, you may proceed, Mr. Dunn.
Thank you, Justices, and good morning. As you know, my name is Robin Dunn. This case involves summary judgment. The decision was entered February 8th and mailed February 11th of 2019. You have my briefs, so I'm going to take a little bit different approach and proceed through what I consider the major issues in this case. The first thing I'd like to talk about is the term judicial privilege. This case is about our new district judge engaged in what I would term respectfully judicial activism, because he adopted California law and I believe did not follow the current state of law in Idaho. Respondent in this particular case is urging this court to adopt the California version of judicial.
I apologize for interrupting. Chief, we have lost Justice Brody. She is going to attempt to connect using her phone. So would you like to just start over with argument?
Yes, stop the clock. Reset it at 25 minutes.
Okay, thank you. Correct.
Mr. Larson, is there any objection in that regard, sir?
No, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Dunn, why don't you start again, sir? And I think we're ready to go.
Thank you, Justices. I'll recap what I started. This is a summary judgment proceeding with the decision entered February 8th of 2019 and the mailing of February 11th, 2019. You have my brief and reply brief. It says pretty much what I would like this court to know. So I'm going to hit theories of the case and start with the term judicial privilege. And this case is about our newest district judge in this area engaged in what I call judicial activism, because he adopted California law. And under California law, it was section 47B of the California Code, and it was explained and upheld in the Hagberg decision. The point I'm trying to make when adopting another state's law is, in this case, the legislature codified the judicial privilege prior to the court interpreting. And so in this case, we do have limited judicial privilege in Idaho, which I recognize. However, the respondent is trying to get you to expand to the California version of judicial privilege. And at page 11 of his brief, the respondent's brief, and page 17, you'll find quotes to some of the Idaho cases. There's Malman v. Engler, there's Borg v. Boas, and Richeson v. Kessler. All three of those cases really have within the court itself. And the reason that we have judicial privilege, in my opinion, is In the courtroom, we want to promote argument and free exchange of words. We have a limited arena with rules that are governed by the rules of evidence and or the rules of civil procedure. The potential for damage in statements made in the courtroom are lessened. We have the ability to cross-examine the persons under oath. The respondent is urging that this judicial privilege expand to police officers, to first responders, and to other individuals outside of the courtroom, probation officers, believing that judicial privilege should be expanded. And I believe that's a legislative function, a court function.
What makes it a legislative function to define a judicial privilege?
Because they're asking you to follow California law, which was done by the legislature under Section 47B of the California Code. It depends upon your philosophy of judicial philosophy as adopted by the U.S. Supreme Court. There are some judges who believe they can expand the law, which is legitimate. And then there's conservative views that say, hey, we believe the legislature should first make the rules, and then we should interpret those rules.
Go ahead, I'm sorry, Justice Mueller.
Oh, I was going to say, Mr. Dunn, if our legislature hasn't addressed the issue, then what's wrong with the courts addressing it through the common law?
There's nothing wrong with that if you believe in judicial activism. It depends upon your individual philosophy of what you do as a justice. You've already established judicial privilege to a certain extent, and I gave you 5 or 6 reasons why it should not be extended outside of the courtroom based upon such things as cross-examination, rules of evidence, rules of civil procedure, that you're not exposed to injury to the common public, that you promote the free exchange of discussion by counsel in the courtroom. So it depends on your philosophy of, as a Supreme Court justice, whether you desire to expand that privilege outside of legislative function. And it can be done either way. The respondent is urging you to...
If it can be done either way, then why do you call it judicial activism? That's nothing more than a propaganda statement.
Well, I don't mean
it to be... This court has imposed privileges in a number of different areas, evidentiary as well as in the common law. And now if we do this, you're accusing this judge as well as this court of judicial activism. And it's nothing more than a propaganda statement. I resent the use of that word in this regard. He may have quoted a California case that came from a statute, but the idea is the same. And I wish you wouldn't use it any longer. So you may proceed, sir.
I'm sorry if I was offended. I didn't intend to be. Anyway, I'm sorry, sir. So anyway, the respondent is asking you to expand the judicial privilege is all I was getting at.
And we understand your argument, and we agree that you have the right to say that, so you may proceed. Thank you.
There's 8 states that, or 8 jurisdictions, states that have expanded it. There's 42 states that have not expanded it. Idaho is currently one of the states that have not expanded it outside of the courtroom. The cases that are cited by the respondent are Malmum, Borg, Richeson, and then the District of Idaho, Christensen v. U.S., which was, if you read it, it's a little bit different than the interpretation I take from counsel's brief. So getting into the facts of this particular case, these two brothers, the plaintiff and the defendant, reside in two different counties, one in Madison County, one in Jefferson County. The search warrant was completed through Madison County, did not involve the prosecutorial Jefferson County, so there was no probable cause, and this particular judge indicated that there was no probable cause that existed to issue a search warrant, that there was no probable cause before a magistrate, and that the statements where they say that there was probable cause from the defendant respondent is merely his affidavit, which did not go to the police and or to the search warrant, but came in through summary judgment.
Mr. Dunn, is the search warrant in the record, the actual warrant?
No.
Why not?
I can't answer that question. I wish I could. It was issued by a magistrate in Madison County. I assume it came from Madison because the plaintiff resides in Madison. The brother resides in Jefferson. They're 5 miles apart. And you know this area quite well as far as geographic, but that's the only thing I can assume. But there was no affidavit that I'm aware of. There were police reports submitted to the Madison County magistrate, but it was relied upon by the Jefferson County prosecutor. And when we alleged the malicious prosecution, it was dismissed in our favor without explanation as to why. There was basically, my clients were arrested in the brother's home in Jefferson County. The police weren't present. It did not occur in their presence, in my opinion, which runs afoul of the recent decision from the Court of Appeals that police officers can't arrest unless misdemeanors occur in their presence.
Well, the reason I'm asking, and perhaps this is a question Mr. Larson's going to need to answer as well, but if the whole issue of probable cause is based upon what the warrant meant and what the warrant said, it's a little difficult to judge that without knowing what the scope of the warrant was. Was the affidavit and warrant suggesting that a crime had been committed on the premises, or just that there was evidence of a crime on the premises? I think depending on how the warrants and the affidavits were worded, it was going to affect our analysis greatly.
They were looking for stolen property from one brother to the other brother. The search warrant occurred in Madison County at the residence of my client. So that's all I can answer that's in the record, to the best of my opinion. I hope I answered you the best I could based upon the record. And I understand what you're saying to me, but there were no probable cause affidavits filed by anyone that I am aware of for the search warrant. Now, the search warrant's different than the malicious prosecution that we're arguing, because no evidence was found based upon the search warrants that was used in any court proceeding. The standard of review we're all quite aware of, but what I've tried to focus on in this particular case is sometimes the standard of review is so well known to attorneys and justices that sometimes we forget that this was a jury trial. The inferences are basically, in my opinion, that of the jury, not of the judge, if there are disputed facts. And then we go to the question of what's disputed and what isn't disputed. The lower court basically broke this down into three categories: tort, contract, and conversion. Count 1 and 2 were tort. Count 3 was contract, quantum merit, and the like, and count four was basically the conversion. The conversion withstood summary judgment along with the counterclaim of the defendant. The tort was dismissed, counts one and two, based upon judicial privilege, which that's why I'm saying that was based upon California law, not on the current state of law in Idaho. And so the contract claim was dismissed based upon the statute of limitation. And that, to me, was a factual dispute between plaintiff and defendant. In this case, we indicated in our affidavit that the tort occurred within 4 years of the complaint, and that was our statement. The court said that was vague, yet the defendant said it occurred in the spring of 2010. And to me, that's a clear factual dispute. They both are not like exact dates, like a certain day in a month. And they seem equally plausible that a fact finder should derive and determine these disputed facts on the issue of statute of limitations.
Did Judge Thompson say that it was vague or that it was conclusory?
He said that our statements were vague because we said within 4 years of the filing of the complaint, yet the defendant's version was in the spring of 2010. They both seem approximately equal to me in terms of disputed facts, but the lower court said that our statement was too vague.
Well, there's nothing specific as to when the work was purportedly performed by Gallister, however you pronounce his name.
Gallister-Berrien, we indicated in affidavit form that it was continuing work where that happens within 4 years of the filing of the complaint, and we had witnesses set for trial. But what they said, the reason I find their version implausible, they said we were well drilling in the spring of 2010. My client doesn't have a well drilling rig, and they did not indicate that he had some form of well drilling rig, and we never have participated in drilling wells. The burden was basically on them to switch the summary judgment issues to us, and we would have addressed the word well drilling rigs because we don't have one, is what I'm saying.
But there's nothing in the record to say when the work was purportedly performed by your clients.
We said the work was purportedly performed within 4 years of the complaint in our affidavit.
But there's no date there. There's nothing to tie it down to when the work was performed, is there?
Exactly what I've said is within 4 years of the complaints, what we wrote. We didn't say like January 12th or anything like that, no.
And isn't it incumbent on the plaintiff to say when the work was performed?
It's incumbent on the plaintiff to rebut the allegation. The burden of proof was on the defendant at summary judgment, and they said the spring of 2010, and we said within 4 years of the complaint. That's the status of the record. Is someone asking me a question?
No, sir. You answered it. Thank you. You may proceed.
Okay. When we get to the actual what happened in this particular case, I didn't believe that we needed to put a specific date because we responded to their allegation of spring of 2010. So we just put within 4 years of the complaint because it was an oral contract between the parties on the contract issues. Now, what happened in this particular case is, going back to the tort issues, is we had a painting that we were working on for the Fremont County Courthouse that was issued by now Senior Judge Keith Walker, and Ovanus Berberian started that painting. He transferred it to my client, who is also an artist, for touch-up and revision. He indicated that he had almost a mental block. And when we returned the painting to his house with permission that we've got in the record by via declaration of my client, it indicated that, you know, we were returning it to his house by permission. He wasn't at the home. My client returned it. He returned later that night. My client was sitting there with him, and the defendant had called the police to come and arrest him, saying we had broken in. My client had broken into his house with his niece, which is Julia Berrien. And so they were there. The lower court admits the record on page 5 of his decision, record of 244-256, is the lower court's decision that there was no probable cause for the search warrant. And he does state that right in the record and in his decision. Then we move on to malicious prosecution. Malicious prosecution is not protected by judicial privilege, because malicious prosecution actually occurs within the court. The lower court indicated that all of the elements were present, that we did not expand on damages at that point in time. We merely indicated that his reputation and good name had been damaged. The painting that was the subject of this dispute is now in the Fremont County Courthouse. It was never stolen, as alleged, and the defendant has indicated that we stole the painting, that we stole other things that came up missing, yet nothing has been found via search warrant or other. And in the art world, their name is kind of how they make their money and their reputation. So we believe that it was extreme and outrageous, the comments made by the defendant outside of the courtroom to others, which we have in form of our affidavit. And he does admit, and he even admits in the brief, that he did say my client was guilty of theft and of trespass.
John, I want to go back to probable cause. You said that Judge Thompson concluded that probable cause did not exist?
That is correct. On page 5 of his decision, which is in the record.
I'm looking at page 6, and I want to read it to you. It says, additionally, the prosecutor applied for and received a search warrant based on the information that he possessed, which would have required the showing of probable cause. The fact that the prosecutor independently pursued the case and the fact that the prosecutor received a search warrant indicate that probable cause for the arrest existed in this case. It is possible for probable cause to exist at the time the complaint is filed, even when the magistrate finds that there is not sufficient proof to bind the suspect over for trial, citing Harold versus Idaho. And because probable cause existed for the charge, the court grants summary judgment to defendants on plaintiff's claim for malicious prosecution. It's hard for me to read that anything other than concluding that Judge Thompson said there was probable cause.
Now go back to page 5 where he says there wasn't probable cause.
I think there wasn't probable cause to bind over, but there was to make an initial charge and to pursue and procure a search warrant.
Well, what happened is the search warrant was not initiated by the Jefferson prosecutor. So the probable cause, we were summoned back in after the initial arrest by virtue of summons which, as you know, doesn't always require probable cause. It has a belief that by the prosecutor that something was occurring, but I read that different than what you've just read to me, that, you know, he did say there was no probable cause, and in his conclusions he finds that. So he said two different things. You're correct, Justice.
Didn't he say there was no finding of probable cause? Correct. He was referring to the magistrate. He wasn't referring to his own view.
Correct. He said, well, there was no finding of probable cause by the magistrate. And then he said on page 6, in his view, there should have been, based upon what Justice Stegner just read. So, yes, I'd agree with you, which he said, no, there wasn't by a magistrate, but there should have been, based upon inferences that he made. And those inferences, to me, should be given to the jury, not to the judge. But you are correct in your thought process.
Chief Justice, I apologize for interrupting. Justice Brody's photo changed, and I just wanted to make sure she was still present.
Very well. Justice Brody, are you present? We will proceed, and Justice Brody will review the...
I am present.
Okay.
Justice Burdick, present.
Very good. May proceed, Mr. Dunn. You have 1 minute and 16 seconds.
Okay. So to answer further, Justice Stegner and Justice Mueller, no attorney gave any advice on probable cause, and there was... The court admits there was no finding by the prosecutor and none by the magistrate on page 5, notwithstanding what he said on page 6. So I can see where there would be some confusion on that particular issue.
And doesn't a magistrate or a district judge have to conclude that there's probable cause for the issuance of a search warrant before it's issued?
That's my understanding, yes. And you have two different counties here, but that's why I think Justice Mueller wanted to review the search warrant itself and the background, which is not in the record.
And don't we presume that the evidence that would support the finding of the district court exists unless you have brought it to our attention by making it a part of the record?
Well, okay, the question for me, and I'm not trying to be evasive when I say this, the burden wasn't on us to establish summary judgment. We were only supposed to rebut that which was presented to us by way of affidavit, which we did do. The inference by the district court is there must have been probable cause, yet there is statements by the that there was no probable cause finding by a magistrate. And so what I'm saying is, regardless, the inferences should be determined by the fact finder, and that would be the jury. So I think there's a dispute of facts that a fact finder may need more information to determine the proper inference. I don't think that in a summary judgment proceeding with a jury, that was the duty of the district court. At least that's my take on this particular matter. Now, the arrest occurred in Jefferson County, and there were no officers present. That's the State v. Clark ruling, that you have to be present when a misdemeanor occurs to arrest. And so I don't know how they actually did that, but they did do it. My clients were subjected to being arrested and removed to Jefferson County, where they were released, and then the prosecutor dismissed. There was no explanation given for the dismissal.
Mr. I don't mean to interrupt, but you're running into your rebuttal time.
Okay, I'll stop.
Thank you. Mr. Larson, on behalf of the respondent.
Thank you, Chief Justice Burdick, members of the court, Mr. Dunn, and Madam Clerk. My name is Larry Larson. I have here with me my associate, Dylan Erickson, who assisted me with the briefing and research in this matter. I too want to address four specific points. I want to talk about the judicial privilege issue. I also want to address the probable cause question, which is an element of the tort of malicious prosecution. And I want to talk about the statute of limitation question and in general, the standards of proof and the standard of review and summary judgment. But on the judicial privilege, we do indeed ask the court to extend the scope of the judicial privilege. Let me interrupt myself. Before I go any further, I want to answer the question that came up earlier about the search warrant. The warrant for the search is not in the record, primarily for two reasons. Number one, we sent Freedom of Information Act or public records request to both Jefferson County Sheriff's Office, Madison County Sheriff's Office, and the District Court in Jefferson County. When we got all that information back, the search warrant simply wasn't there. We did continue to make some effort to get additional information, but our time for filing a summary judgment was running out, and we simply never completed our information gathering. We just didn't cover that document, and so that's why it's not in the record. Furthermore, I did not recognize in time the importance of that issue. This whole question about probable cause and judicial privilege and so forth kind of arose late in our research of the case as we prepared for summary judgment. And by the time it was apparent how important that was, it was really too late to try to get that in the record. So I take responsibility for that information being missing from the record. The plaintiff, Galusberian and counsel, want to limit the scope of the judicial privilege in three ways. Number one, that it would apply only to statements made to lawyers and judges, not to people, not like law enforcement, not to police or deputy sheriffs. They want to limit the privilege to statements made only to lawyers and judges. They want to limit the privilege only to statements made in a courtroom proceeding or a similar venue. And they want it not to apply to any tort claims other than defamation. And that currently is where the law stands. At this time, it's arguable that it only applies to statements made to lawyers and judges in the courtroom, and it only it impacts claims against communicator in the context of a defamation claim. But let me address each one of those. The fact is that there are Idaho cases where the judicial privilege has been applied to, or at least the statement has been made that it applies to statements made not just in the courtroom, but during preliminary steps leading up to proposed litigation. In Borg v. Boas, for example, the statements that gave rise to that cause of action were made in a town hall meeting at which a judge was present. In Mullman v. Engler, the statement is made, and it was apparent that those statements were made at that time in a context prior to the filing of litigation. Then in Dickinson Frozen Foods case and Taylor versus McNichols, in both of those cases, although it was dicta, the court stated that the privilege applies to statements made in situations, proceedings, or circumstances preliminary to or leading up to proposed litigation. So it is clear that under current Idaho law, the litigation privilege, judicial privilege, does apply and protect litigants for statements made during preliminary type activities.
If the statements are made out of court, is it an absolute privilege or a qualified privilege?
Well, it's a qualified privilege in all events in the sense that it only applies if the statement is reasonably related to a action or proposed action. And so it's a qualified privilege in that sense.
What if the statement's made in bad faith?
Makes no difference. For the purposes of the judicial privilege or the litigation privilege, a statement can be made that's false, and the person making the statement can know that it's false, but it is still privileged and cannot be used to support a claim for defamation.
Well, that would sound almost like an absolute privilege then, if you have a freedom to make knowingly false statements.
In that sense, it is an absolute privilege. That's correct. But that is clearly the law, even though the declarant knows that the statement is false, it is still privileged. And the purpose of that is public policy. Public policy is that we have a judicial system that needs to give aggrieved parties a reasonable opportunity to resolve grievances, to resolve disputes without resorting to non-judicial remedies, self-help remedies, or vigilantism, or whatever it might be. In particular context of criminal proceedings, if a witness or a victim of criminal conduct seeks redress in some way, he needs to be encouraged to go to law enforcement.
Doesn't that create somewhat of a false dichotomy, though, between vigilantism and abuse of process? I mean, it would seem to me there might be some room in between there, and that there might be room for a public policy which discourages people from intentionally and knowingly lying to police.
Well, that particular problem is adequately addressed, according to decisions that deal with this, adequately addressed by the fact that a person who is maligned by some accuser falsely may not be able to sue for defamation, but can have that person brought up on charges for filing false reports to law enforcement or other remedies. There are other types of criminal prosecutions, but no
perjury, like perjury, for example.
Perjury. However, there are no civil actions that can be taken when the litigation or judicial privilege applies.
Mr. Larson, isn't it also true, though, that the public policy behind absolute privilege is a minority view in the United States, that the majority view leans more towards a qualified privilege?
I am not aware of that. I don't know that. I can't answer that. I'm sorry. As Mr. Dunn pointed out, we uncovered eight cases, actually nine, where states have extended the judicial privilege to other tort claims beyond defamation. He says 42 haven't. I can't even confirm that. We just haven't found any others. We found eight or nine, but we haven't found others. I don't know what the majority versus minority rule is there. Now, the fact that the privilege clearly extends to proceedings preliminary to litigation or preliminary to filing criminal charges makes it natural to question whether that it should be limited only to lawyers and judges. Most people who want to report a crime don't go to the prosecuting attorney or to a judge. They go to law enforcement, they go to the sheriff, they go to the police. That's where statements are made accusing people of criminal conduct. I don't have any statistical information, but it just makes common sense that most times when statements are made accusing people of crimes, those are first made to law enforcement. And so we're talking about the privilege applying outside the context of the courtroom or the proceedings themselves. Typically, it's because law enforcement is involved. And in fact, in the case of Borg Verboas, statements were made to a prosecutor prior to any filing of litigation. And although it was, I think it was probably dicta in that case, it does make it clear that statements can be made to law enforcement rather than to a prosecutor or a judge, and the litigation privilege will still apply. Let me go on more importantly, though, to the question of the scope of the privilege as it applies to various tort claims. Obviously, almost all states have adopted the rule that the privilege applies to prevent claims of defamation, tort claims for defamation. Many states, many courts have observed that it is very easy for a litigant, a victim of defamatory statements, to sue not for defamation, but for some other theory of relief, such as invasion of privacy, intentional or negligent infliction of emotional distress, and things of that nature. And so, as was pointed out earlier, 8 or 9 states, depending upon how you count, have adopted the rule that the litigation privilege, judicial privilege, applies to all tort claims based upon defamatory statements other than malicious prosecution. Malicious prosecution, by nature, appears to have a different kind of element structure, and it does not appear to be, from a standpoint of public policy, necessary to protect declarants against that kind of a claim as much as defamation or other similar tort claims. And so it's generally recognized as an exception to the rule. As of yet, Idaho has not adopted that expansion of the scope of the privilege. But let me point out 3 cases where the court is definitely moving that direction. In the case of Taylor versus McNichols, if I can remind myself of the fact setting, in the case of Taylor versus McNichols, an action was filed against an attorney for statements made in a complaint. Don't remember the underlying nature of the case, but this was a case where an attorney was sued for defamation based upon statements that he had made in a complaint. And the court recognized the common law rule that attorneys are immune from claims of libel or defamation for statements made in judicial proceedings. But in that case, the plaintiff had also alleged civil conspiracy and interference with contract based upon the statements made in the complaint, defamatory statements made in the complaint. So there were these other tort theories the plaintiff was relying upon. And this is an Idaho court, 2010, the Idaho Supreme Court, 2010, addressed the expansion of the privilege in other jurisdictions and noted that many jurisdictions have extended the claim of judicial privilege to other tort claims. And also discussed the issue that in this particular case, the claims are based upon the attorney's conduct, not just his statements. And so in ruling on the case, the district court had ruled that, had dismissed ruled for summary judgment in favor of the defendant based upon the judicial privilege and reasoned based upon other jurisdictions' rulings that judicial privilege ought to apply to all tort claims, not just claims for defamation. at least as far as statements are concerned. The Supreme Court, however, overruled the district court because this case had to do with conduct, not statements. And the court made an interesting comment. The court said, even if we were to expand the judicial privilege to cover other tort claims, that's not this case. This case is only about conduct. But we will agree that a attorney is protected against, attorney statements and conduct are protected from all claims based upon common law that protects attorneys specifically. So the ruling in Taylor versus McNichols was that attorneys specifically are immune from prosecution for any tort claims based upon defamatory statements or their conduct in the course of litigation, except only cases where they are acting outside the scope of their representation of the client or they're acting solely for their self-interest. So in the case of attorneys.
Mr. Larson, excuse me, I want to ask a hypothetical question. Let's assume a couple is in a contentious divorce and one of the litigants decides that it would be advantageous to accuse the other spouse of sexual improprieties with the child or children of that marriage. And that spouse goes to law enforcement and accuses the other spouse of sexual impropriety, knowing that it's not accurate, but using it as a means to prevent the other spouse from enjoying care and comfort for the children. Wouldn't an absolute privilege afforded to somebody who makes a malicious charge against someone prevent that defamed spouse from bringing that cause of action against the spouse who made the accusations of sexual impropriety?
Well, an absolute privilege. So you're talking about the client and you're talking about the attorney, but your question is whether the client, whether a litigant ought to be protected against defamation claims, first of all, if a litigant makes false statements, defamatory statements about the other party, we already have that absolute privilege. That is the judicial privilege that we have now. It absolutely protects litigants against defamation claims reasonably related to the proceeding. And even though the litigant, the party, knows that the statements are false, that is our current law, state of the law.
So what case are you relying on? What authority are you relying on for that proposition? Nichols.
Well, Malman and Richardson.
Malman involved a lawyer talking to the magistrate in court, didn't it? I'm talking about the litigant who goes to the police and makes a false accusation against either an ex-spouse or perhaps a brother. Why should they be cloaked with absolute immunity from making those statements if they are provably false? What policy is promoted by allowing that?
If that statement is made in the environment or a setting where there's either litigation pending or there's a sincere intent of bringing litigation, the public policy is to promote the willingness of people to use our judicial system and to be able to speak freely without the fear of being sued if they are proven wrong.
The fear of repercussions for lying? I mean, shouldn't we promote a policy that dissuades people from lying to the police?
Well, we have laws that prevent people from lying to the police. We have laws for filing false police report, false reports to the police. That is a crime.
I'm not sure that your example of the defamed spouse, or my example of the defamed spouse, would find much solace in a criminal charge being brought or being declined by the prosecutor. I mean, the person who's been defamed has no ability to redress the wrongs that they've suffered.
It's a balancing effort. It's a trade-off. We have interests in society. We have personal interests, we have societal interests. You hate to take away someone's right to file tort claims against a perpetrator of a crime or someone who causes injury. You hate to take away those rights because that may be the person's ability to get compensated for damages. But sometimes for the sake of promoting a societal interest, we do take away a person's ability to get compensation for their damages.
But why don't we make that a qualified privilege and say, we will give you a qualified privilege so long as you're not lying to the police or maliciously accusing someone of something they didn't do?
The reason we don't make it a qualified privilege is because we want people who want to tell the truth to be able to do so without fearing that somehow some jury that is misled or misunderstands or something will find them guilty of telling a lie.
But they're protected, but if they're telling the truth, they're protected with a qualified privilege. They're not protected if they lie.
They're only protected with a qualified privilege if a subsequent jury agrees they were telling the truth. But a jury might not be able to tell the difference between the truth and a lie when they get tried for that tort of defamation.
I know you're running out of time, and I think I'd like to have us move a little bit more towards the direction of probable cause, because I think this is directly related to what we're talking about. For the elements of malicious prosecution that we've recognized, malice, making a knowingly false statement, is part of it, but I think there was an attempt to soften that along the lines that you're suggesting by also an element requiring a lack of probable cause. And so it's not enough just to show there was malice, but there has to be a lack of probable cause. Could you discuss the probable cause issues in this case and some of the problems that Mr. Dunn has noted?
Yes, I would be glad to. Before I move on, though, just let me point out that case I mentioned, Taylor versus Nichols, gives a very broad privilege to attorneys. The case of Overman versus Klein gives a very broad absolute privilege to witnesses. And my point is, if attorneys have a broad absolute privilege against all tort claims, and witnesses have a broad absolute privileges against all tort claims, why shouldn't the party in the case have a broad absolute privilege against all tort claims other than malicious prosecution? And that concludes my discussion of the judicial privilege. But let's talk about probable cause. We have to be clear, first of all, that the element of probable cause doesn't have to do with whether or not the defendant, the in this case the plaintiff, the alleged criminal, the suspect, it does not have to do with whether the suspect is innocent or guilty. It has to do with the reasonable good faith belief of the declarant or the accuser in what he's accusing. So here, the standard of review is on summary judgment, where there's two ways for the accuser to establish probable cause. One is by pointing to the evidence, circumstances that he was aware of at the time he made the accusations, circumstances that reasonably supported his good faith belief or even a strong suspicion that the accused party had committed a crime. So you can look at that evidence, and he can, the jury in the end, can make an independent determination whether or not the circumstances that the accuser was aware of reasonably supported his accusations. That's one way for the accuser to prove probable cause for his accusations. And the other way is called the advice of counsel rule, although that's kind of a misnomer. If a prosecuting attorney or a magistrate in the course of the proceedings have independently found probable cause that the accused committed a crime, to believe that the accused committed a crime.
That's what I'd like to ask you about, Mr. Larson. If my understanding of the facts is incorrect, please feel free to disabuse me of anything I say that's wrong. But my understanding is that your theory of the case is kind of hiding behind the robes of the judge and saying, well, a judge found probable cause to issue a search warrant. And that certainly appears to be true, although we don't know exactly what the basis for that conclusion was. But we also know that another judge looked at the facts of the case and didn't find that there was probable cause to proceed to court on the case. And I guess my question to you is, probable cause to issue a search warrant, the same probable cause that's needed to defend or to defend against this type of action, when a judge that was asked to determine whether there was probable cause that a crime committed concluded that there wasn't? In other words, is probable cause to search the same as probable cause that a crime was committed?
Well, it's not defined the same way, but in substance, it is the same. Probable cause to search has to do with, is there probable cause to believe that a search of a premises will uncover relevant evidence of a crime? Well, that question kind of subsumes the question, is there a probable cause to believe a crime was committed? And if the premises is the suspect's premises, then it also includes the is there probable cause to believe that this suspect committed the crime? So probable cause.
Isn't that a leap of logic, though? I mean, there may be probable cause to suspect that there's evidence of a crime somewhere, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the owner of the property where the search was executed is the suspect. Now, it would help if we had the affidavit and the search warrant that suggested that, but we don't have that.
Under the circumstances of this case, I would say that the test for the search warrant is the same as the test for probable cause to believe that Galoose Berrien committed a theft in the context of this case, because the search warrant was issued after all the facts occurred, after all the events occurred. The large painting Approaching Storm was taken from Ovanis's house. Their version of the story is that Ovanis wanted Galoose to take it and fix it. So it was taken. The very day almost, we don't know because we don't know when that was taken, and we don't know when everything else was taken, but in the same compact time frame of a few days, not only was the Approaching Storm taken from Galoose's house, but hundreds of thousands of dollars of other paintings were taken from his house. What are the chances that the same day Galoose goes to pick up the big painting, some other thief is stealing everything else? There's no other likely suspects than Galoose, especially when Galoose had the painting, and there's no question he had it, and brought it back and broke into his house to give it back. So there's this history up to that point and captured on video in the process of breaking in. So at that point is when the search warrant was issued. The search warrant was issued based upon all of that history, which was recorded in detail, statements to the police by Galoose and others, investigation notes from the sheriff's office, Detective Pettengill, phone calls to Galoose that never got returned, letters written to Galoose that never got answered, a long history of events pointing to Galust Berrien. At that point, the magistrate in Madison County, I presume, issued the search warrant. Now, it's fair to infer that probable cause existed from the issues. Let me make one more comment. There's nothing in the record that says any magistrate looked at this case and found there's no probable cause to go forward. If we're talking about...
Sir, at this time, your time is up. We appreciate your argument. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
How much time does the appellant have?
3 minutes, Your Honor.
Mr. Dunn, you may proceed. Sir, we cannot hear you. Cannot hear you.
The host has muted me.
There you go.
Yeah, the host muted me. Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to make quick argument because I have a little time. Judicial privilege, the five cases cited by the defendant, Malmum, Borg, Richardson, Christensen versus U.S., and Taylor versus Mickles, all involved attorneys, all involved judges, and were either in the courtroom or preliminary to the courtroom. None of them involved police officers, probation officers, first responders, which they're urging you to adopt as a case of first impression in Idaho. Under the probable cause, number two, I could only rebut what was put forth in the summary judgment. There was nothing in the record from defendant to indicate that probable cause as concluded by the district judge that Justice Stegner brought up. There's two different pages. One, he says there was no finding by a magistrate. And then the second page, of course, was a little bit different version. So there's nothing in the record that I could rebut. And I think that the burden's on the defendant who is, I'm the non-moving party to present the evidence. The public policy arguments against judicial privilege being expanded, I previously pointed out that we want free dialogue in the court system. Just like, for example, I got chastised a little bit by you for maybe statements that were maybe inflammatory, but was dialogue, which I apologize for. But we're in the court system. They've said that my client in the court system was a thief, and that was via their affidavits in summary judgment, and those are protected also in the court system. So what I'm saying is I can only rebut that which is before me, and as the non-moving party, I'm supposed to be given all inferences of liberal instruction towards me in a summary judgment proceeding. The defamation that we talk about in the judicial privilege is less invasive than being arrested and loss of privacy. And that's why I am arguing, please do not extend this because it's a chilling event to victims, as Justice Stegner is pointing out. They indicate that perjury or filing reports through a prosecutorial entity is the solution. That removes our ability to seek justice in a civil court. And the restatement of torts second indicates that it is the desire to have people have free access to the court system. Well, if you extend judicial privilege,
Mr. Dunn.
Yes.
Excuse me, sir. Your time is up. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I appreciate counsel's argument. I appreciate the importance of the case. This matter is now under advisement. We will render a decision. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Good to see you both again.
You too. Yeah. Thank you.